It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Move over, WWE. The WWGOP is front and center. The team of trained monkeys hopping around on display. I got to tell you, I was expecting Mean Gene Okerlund to come out of the box. I was waiting for it. I'm serious. I mean, what we saw today from the Republicans, WWE, you got nothing on them. This was, for wrestling fans, you gotta look at the showmanship and go, you know, good job. You've spent years honing your craft. Now, this isn't about governing. This isn't about making lives better. This isn't about doing any of the things we talk about that need to get done. This isn't about getting stuff done. This is about, scoring points. This is about, oh, yeah, snap into a Slim Jim. It's about the next gig. It's about the next thing they can sell. It's about, hey, look at me. Maybe I can get on Fox News. It's insane what has happened to our political arena. Yes, it's the arena. It's crazy. But predictable. This is the world that we're in. And look, I know people in Congress. When you talk to them aside, you realize that the showmanship, the game, what we see on the cable news channels and the kind of display that we see is all staged. It's all political theater. It's all bread and circus. It's all to keep us at each other so that we don't demand that they actually get something done. They score their points with a minority of their base. It's going to keep them all tingly in the panties and all wadded up. And nothing gets done. From the January 6th Select Committee to an infrastructure bill to, you know, paying our freaking bills, the GOP is using every stunt, every gimmick, every scam, everything that they can dream up to get nothing done. There was a moment, and this is one of those things where I want to start today with, there was a moment of truth. And it's one of those things where you just go, There's a couple of moments in time where truth is possible. And I look at House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who today, you know, really, you know, good on him, put on a good display. Mean Gene would have been proud. Hulk Hogan would have, you know, come back with the fist arising, you know, and all of that. But on January 6th, there was a moment of truth. And the reason we know this is because Washington Republican Representative Jamie Herrera Butler came out and said, look, you know, this is what happened when we finally got through to Donald Trump, when Kevin McCarthy finally got through and was told by Trump that the people out in the streets are more upset about him losing the election than Kevin McCarthy is. And, you know, in this expletive-laden back and forth about telling Trump to stop what was going on, that was a moment of truth. That was Kevin McCarthy, one, worried that maybe he was going to get lynched. And I think that kind of fear brings out visceral reactions that are honest. And this is why I said from the beginning, this committee, this commission, whatever, should have started within a week of January 6th, or at least on January 21st. Because the farther we get away from the horrible activities of that day, the treason, the sedition of that day, the more you're going to get the spinmeisters at Fox News and further insane to spin it to go, no. It wasn't an insurrection. It was just another tourist day. It was a good day. Oh, yeah, a little glass got broken, but that's okay. They were just a little rambunctious, a little over-anxious. You got the president himself saying the reason that they were doing it was to stop the certification of the election. You've got people coming out and saying, yeah, that's the reason we went. Wasn't that the whole reason? It's a revolution. We were storming the Capitol to stop the business of the House of Representatives, to stop the certification of the election. That's why they did it. And it's interesting that Trump even admitted it. And you can't get the Kevin McCarthys of the world to go on with it. Now, the story today, clearly, Kevin McCarthy came out with his handful of representatives that he wants on the select committee. And Nancy Pelosi said, sorry, we're not going to put Jim Jordan and Jim Banks on the committee. Personally, I think it was a dumb idea. I think you should have left Jim Jordan and Jim Banks there. Let them do their dog and pony show. That just me. I would have left them there. And I would have ridiculed them at every opportunity, and I would have highlighted their insanity and their loyalty and highlighted what they were doing. Now, I do understand why she said, no, these are unprecedented times. We're not doing this. We're not turning this into a dog and pony show. I do understand it. Personally, don't agree with it. This is going to give them the opportunity to do more of this WWGOP grandstanding that they're really good at. And why are they good at it? They got a lot of places to do it. Understand, conservative right-wing media is dominant in this country. It is the dominant media in this country. Now everyone, no, Rick, no. The liberal ABCs and NBCs, the liberal alphabet media. I love how they turn that. I love how they turn that for themselves. It's not true, but they repeat it often enough that they've even convinced themselves. But like I said, I think it was a mistake. But here's the thing, and this is the part that really is kind of infuriating. Because Republicans had an opportunity to not have this partisan committee. They had an opportunity to have a nonpartisan select committee of people to investigate this. With deadlines, with all kinds of things that I wasn't thrilled with. They had a chance to vote for it, and they chose not to. So understand, from the beginning of this, they don't want to get to the bottom of it. They don't want the fingers pointed at who's responsible. Donald Trump and all of the Republican legislators, people like Jim Jordan, who stoked the fires and riled these people up. The representatives who gave tours the day before and the days before. We need to see this. The moneyed interests who funded this stuff. The political action committees who stoked the flames. We need to investigate this stuff. And the Republicans clearly don't want that to happen. They clearly do not. And look, someone like Banks and Jordan, they are people who are diehard Trump people. They're going to be basically Trump's defense team. And I get why Pelosi doesn't want them there, but I think it's a mistake to not have them there. Because they are going to do the WWGOP stuff. They are going to grandstand. They are going to try and move the narrative to a more favorable narrative for Trump. Understand, there was one guy there that day saying, we're going to the Capitol. There was one guy there that day who was saying, we're going to stop this. One guy. It's crazy. But again, this isn't unpredictable. The stuff that we see, the divisions that we see, are not unpredictable. This is who the WWGOP is. This is wrestling stuff. This is all designed for the camera. And look, I have friends who are huge wrestling fans. Some of them, this is the fun part, some of them think it's real. And this is the thing that And I just had this conversation today. Some of the folks there are actually internalizing that every attack that the Republicans throw out and want us to believe is imminent. They internalize. I know people, you can't get a positive word out of them. Everybody's attacking them. The world is against them and they're fighting everybody because that's the Republican mindset. That's the elixir that they've thrown out to get people hooked on this kind of grievance radio and TV, this kind of anger politics. To where it's not about getting things done. It's not about making roads and bridges better. It's not about educating children. It's not about healthcare. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about scoring points and punishing the other side. We're going to tick off those libtards. And anything that moves us forward as a country. Now understand, we're under attack. We are in the midst of a foreign-led civil war. The sad reality is most of us don't understand it. Because our fault lines are being really highlighted by foreign actors. And they're using social media to do it. And we buy into it. And our politicians buy into it. Again, they could have set up a nonpartisan committee. They could have voted for it, and they didn't. And then you see these stories, oh, immediately they regretted it. It's buyer's remorse. They knew exactly what they were doing. And again, we're going to see this political theater play out again. Mitch McConnell came out and said that the Senate, this is great. This is one of those things he just goes, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. But Mitch McConnell has now come out and said that they're not going to do any debt ceiling raising anytime soon. Not going to happen. There will be no Republicans who will vote to raise the debt ceiling. Yet the last guy spent, you know, trillions of dollars. Raised the debt ceiling for that. We already spent the money. Again, the time to fight these things is before you spend the money. Now we've got a debt ceiling that we're going to bump up against, and now it's going to be the same kind of grandstanding and the same kind of, oh, how much we care about debt and deficits. And it's going to be comical because they're going to pretend like they've never run up a deficit, that they've never given away trillions of dollars to the very wealthy and big corporations, that they're not, you know, tax and spenders or borrow and spenders, that they are. No. They're clean as the driven snow. And the same thing, we're watching it happen right now with vaccines. We're now seeing people like Sean Hannity telling people to get vaccinated. We're seeing people like Mitch McConnell going, well, you know, I don't know. You know, we should be getting vaccinated. You know, we got three safe vaccines. I don't know why people ain't doing it. You go, dum-dum, your party's been saying it's been a hoax. Your party's the one who's saying, no, don't do it. And now they're dying. And now we're looking down the barrel of another spike where potentially thousands more people are going to die every day. And now someone's coming around going, well, you know, hold on, we better change our tune on this because the people who are dying, uh-oh, those are our people. Now, remember when Jared Kushner said, you know, it's just New York, just Washington. Those aren't our people. Don't worry about it. Because it was Democrats getting sick. Now that it's the Fox News viewers, now that it's these rural states and these rural districts that are going, uh-oh, we ain't got no healthcare system here to take care of us. We're kind of screwed. Now you're seeing the conservatives going, no, you should probably get vaccinated. We should probably do this. And it's too far gone. They are too far gone. And it's going to take their base dying. And maybe that's the lesson learned. I mean, maybe that's it. Today, there was a cloture vote on the infrastructure bill. Republicans blocked the cloture vote. Doing again, this WWGOP stuff. They agreed to a bipartisan bill. And now you got people, no, we need to slow down. You know, we need to get it right. Rob Portman. And I got to be honest, one of Portman's comments I actually liked. He said, you know, we're just not ready. I mean, the bill's still being negotiated. So, yeah, it's not going to be uncork the wine and or the little kings. I'm going, hey, I remember Little Kings. That was good beer. Good for you. At least having one decent thing to say. But he says, no, we need more time. And more time means we're going to drag this out as long as we can so that next election comes around, we can take credit for it. That's what that means, because that's the political theater. That's the gamesmanship in all of this. You can't give Joe Biden a win on infrastructure because people will be happy that they have jobs. They'll be happy that their community is getting the infrastructure that they need. They'll be happy that their internet doesn't suck. They'll be happy that their kids are going to get an education. They're going to be happy. They're going to be happy. And when people are happy, they're not mad. And when they're not mad, you can't rile them up. And these kind of bizarre tactics that we've been seeing the Republicans get away with don't work. When you can't make people jealous or angry, their tactics don't work. So what they have to do is they have to make sure they keep throwing the wrench into the gears. They need to keep gumming things up. They need to keep slowing things down so things don't get done. So that people give me the, well, you know, Rick, them there Democrats and Republicans, they're all alike. And in some ways they are. You're not going to get an argument out of me on corporate interests and all of that. But when it comes down to actually helping people and getting things done, there's a huge difference, a monumental difference. For me, the number one difference is I haven't found a pro-labor Republican politician outside of a major city. There's one here in Pennsylvania, Fitzpatrick in Philly. You can't find another one. And the Republican Party has been vehemently anti-union. Yet I talk to union members every day. I'm a diehard Republican. Why? Because of what I see on TV. I'm angry like they are. I've bought the lies. I've bought the showmanship. Because I like wrestling. Because that's basically what our political system has turned into. A Saturday Night Raw. Sad stuff. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day some of the worst violence of the Great Railroad Strike erupted in Pittsburgh. The strike started days earlier. It's contested as to whether it began in Martinsburg, West Virginia, or Baltimore, Maryland. The strike spread rapidly along the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad to New York State, Pennsylvania, and throughout the Midwest. At its height, the Great Railroad Strike involved well over 100,000 workers. The strike began on the Pennsylvania Railroad on the 19th. Management repeatedly tried to move trains through the yards and was confronted by angry strikers. Pennsylvania guardsmen were called out. The strikers presented the railroad with their demands. They wanted an end to double-engine trains that required fewer workers, wages reinstated, reinstatement for their fired co-workers, and an end to pay grades. Local militia sided with the strikers and refused to show for duty. When thousands of strikers gathered at the depot, the Pennsylvania National Guard moved unsuccessfully to disperse them. Then they fired on the strikers, killing 20 and wounding 29. The strikers were infuriated by the deadly aggression and drove guardsmen into a nearby railroad roundhouse. Word spread quickly throughout the city of the massacre, launching a virtual general strike. Workers began seizing arms wherever they could find them. They set fires to dozens of railroad buildings, burned down the Union Depot, destroyed over 100 locomotives, and more than 1,000 freight and passenger cars. The next day, guardsmen shot their way out of the roundhouse, killing 20 more as they were chased from the city. A total of 3,000 federal troops would be necessary to quell strikers' fury by month's end. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So like I said, you know, I'm still frustrated by the performance that we're seeing, the bread and circus that we're seeing coming out of D.C., but not as angry as I am at the news media from yesterday and even bleeding into today about Jeff Bezos and defending, you know, our billionaire who just decided, hey, I'm going to go up for a little ride in the sky like an amusement park ride. There was no rhyme or reason to why they went. There was no scientific purpose. It was just because, hey, I can. And in that one little moment of clarity, and look, I give Bezos credit. He was honest. Guy's honest. He came right out and told the truth.
And then I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this. So seriously, for every Amazon customer out there and every Amazon employee, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Oh, thank you for paying for all of this and the rest of my lifestyle, the $500 million little boat I'm going to be floating around in, and all of the other things. Thank you for not taking breaks or going to the bathroom or doing any of those things or asking for a union. Thank you for that. So I can go play in space. Just nuts to me and angering. But again, you know, we paid for it, which is why we need to have policies to hold people like this accountable. But here again, we can't seem to get an infrastructure plan through. Thanks, GOP, today. There was no cloture vote going to happen. I think everyone knew that. And here to share some thoughts on, are we going to get an infrastructure bill on either side? Is the right going to be able to torpedo it, or will AOC and the squad take it down as well? Here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked our good friend Max Burns to come talk with us. Max is a Democratic strategist, also a columnist over at the Daily Beast. He's got a new piece out on that very topic of, you know, could it be possible that AOC and the squad take this down? Max, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So surprised that no cloture vote today?
Not really. I think Republicans sort of signaled earlier in the week that they weren't ready. Mitt Romney asked Chuck Schumer to delay until next week this vote that happened today. I think most people thought this would fail. It doesn't necessarily set things back much, as Schumer can come back and take this vote again next week. But who knows what's going to happen there. And we're once again just letting Republicans decide the pace of action. And it's baffling for a party that's in control of the Senate.
Yeah, but it comes back to it. We've got problems. You got Joe Manchin, Kelly, you've got Sinema, you've got problems.
There are, and so much attention has been paid to Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin that the progressive side of this equation has been completely forgotten. And in the House, they're starting to take notice of that. You see, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley have all said that if this infrastructure bill doesn't include significant social infrastructure spending, and that's caretakers for the elderly, after school attendance for kids who need after school care, these things that keep our economy running through people power, if that isn't included in the budget, they're not going to vote for it. And they have the votes to essentially kill infrastructure, even if it passes the Senate.
Yeah. So now you pointed out in your piece that J.P. Morgan, their market note, predicted that we were going to get one or the other. You're going to get the bipartisan plan or the reconciliation plan. There was no way that both of them were going to pass. Is that where your mindset is?
I am a bit more optimistic, and I think Joe Biden certainly needs to be, because he needs both of these to pass for this trick to essentially work. He needs the bipartisan bill to get most of the hard infrastructure that he wants and that Joe Manchin wants. But he also needs this party line reconciliation bill to pass with as much climate spending, as much social infrastructure spending as possible, to make sure that AOC and the squad and the left have something that they can claim victory on too. If just that bipartisan bill comes to the House with nothing for the left, I would expect to see a huge fight on the floor of the House. That would be a huge distraction for Joe Biden.
Yeah, I agree. So this is why, you know, Biden said that they were going to move them both at the same time. But this is where it's kind of like that chicken and egg thing, where, you know, if you bring that bipartisan bill and you do move, you know, that priority, you know, you're probably not getting the other side of it. So, you know, look, I'm not surprised that, you know, Omar and Ocasio-Cortez and the rest of them are saying, no, wait, we want to make sure that we get actual people some help, too. I'm not surprised by that.
No, and they're absolutely right. I mean, climate change infrastructure is in many ways the only infrastructure that matters, because if we don't build that out now, in 20 years, the infrastructure we build from this package will have to be replaced from the effects of climate change.
Right.
I mean, this is a situation where Joe Biden has gotten so focused on winning GOP support that he's forgotten that there is a wing of this party that was critical to electing him that has not felt a lot of love from the Democratic Party lately, and they're making their frustration known.
No, and look, I understand that, but I come from the school of, you know, I want the possible over the perfect. I'm willing to give up some things. I'm willing to make some compromise to get something done, because I realize, and I've seen this through years of following political stuff, that we get into these moments where we end up 6 months down the road with nothing. And if that happens, the Democrats are toast in 22.
No, absolutely. I mean, infrastructure has to pass. And this will be a real test of principle for the left. I think if AOC can hold together this coalition, then she puts herself in an incredible negotiating position. But if it starts to fracture, I think that spells a real tough time for the left, which is already facing some internal challenges. But I mean, Democrats have got to deliver on this. There is no alternative. There's no going back and saying Republicans outplayed us. Voters are expecting this. They were promised this, and they will revolt if they don't get it.
No, I mean, there's a budget in this that I want to see. You know, first and foremost, I want to see the PRO Act as part of the reconciliation bill, because I know Republicans are not going to restore labor rights in this country where we need to get them, so that people, as we're building this critical infrastructure and we're doing these things, that workers have the ability to actually benefit from them. What's the sense of making a bunch of crummy low-wage jobs and where people aren't getting ahead and families aren't doing better? What's the point of doing that? I'd say we have to have both of them.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I mean, this is all funded through tax increases on the wealthy and an increase in IRS enforcement, except now the GOP, through Rob Portman, said over the weekend they will not accept any increase in the IRS's funding to go after tax cheats, to go after people who are hiding their assets. Democrats need to find some other way to pay for this bill. And it just shows you that the Republicans are not serious about addressing these core problems.
Yeah.
We could pay for this bill year one with proper funding for the IRS to go after tax cheats. There's a reason Republicans don't want the IRS doing that. And that's that a lot of those tax cheats are on their donor rolls.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that's weird to me, because, you know, I talk to Republican voters, you know, diehard, you know, and they're the ones who are still wearing the T-shirts. And the tax issue is one of those things that they get. You know, when I start turning a conversation to going, okay, you're against, you know, the left and you're against all this stuff, you start talking about taxes, you start talking about, you know, Jeff Bezos going up into space and paying a lower tax rate than working people are. They get that. So I'm kind of in this weird spot of going, how is it that Republicans are not doing the polling on their own base, who this has got to be popular with?
Yeah, I think Republicans are committing the same sort of mistake now that Democrats with Hillary Clinton did in 2016, which is taking for granted where their voters are. The GOP thinks with Trump, they have these voters. They'll do whatever Trump tells them to do. They'll vote for Republicans if Trump tells them to do it. And we know from history that's not true. These voters will vote for Donald Trump, absolutely. The rest of the GOP is on its own. And part of the reason Joe Biden was so successful this last cycle was talking to Republicans who are losing jobs, who are being priced out of their own neighborhoods, and saying, you know, it upsets me too that Jeff Bezos has his own space program and you can't even get money to retrain for a different job. And those are the kind of messages that resonate. And right now, Republicans are in the way. So that only hurts them.
So what is the messaging out of today then? I mean, you know, you seem a little bit more forgiving about it not going forward because Romney and others did ask for another week. So let's say we give them another week down the road, we don't get a cloture vote. What's the message out of that? Because, you know, I'm looking at it going, This infrastructure bill, especially the hard infrastructure bill, those are millions of good, solid union wage jobs that can be created all across this country with a reverberation effect in every local economy across this country. Red state, blue state, purple state, green state, it doesn't matter. This is a big deal. And yet, if we don't get something else, what's the messaging out of that?
Yeah. And if I sound overly understanding of Chuck Schumer, which is not my normal mode, it's because I understand what's at stake here. We need these jobs that this bill will bring. We need this economic investment. And quite frankly, the messaging coming out of this should be one of unity within the party, of saying we'll give Republicans the extra couple days they asked for. Sure, we'll take the vote again on Monday or Tuesday. But if they back down again, if they change the goalposts again, we stuff all of that bill into reconciliation and pass it with 50 votes in Kamala Harris. We're done with them. We move on. And then we figure out what the House needs to get it through.
Ultimately, is that the plan? Yeah, ultimately, do you think that's the plan? Do you think Sinema and Kelly and Warner and Manchin, do you think they, in that environment, in that scenario, do you think they come along with the big plan?
Oh, yeah. I think the only way you show Manchin that there's no way out is to keep taking these votes where Republicans refuse to come along. And eventually you have to say, you know, Joe, we've taken 10 votes on this. The bipartisanship you promised is not happening. Let's put this in reconciliation and get it done as Democrats. If we can't do it together, let's at least do it.
Yeah,
and I mean, that should be the messaging going forward.
No, I look at Manchin and I'm going, man, this guy has such leverage that he could get a huge, huge influx of investment, of infrastructure, of job training, of anything he wants out of this bill to make his state better off. And I know those talks are happening, but I'm like, man, you could really leverage this thing to benefit your state.
Yeah. And Joe Manchin knows that. I mean, that's why Joe Manchin supports reconciliation. That's one of the reasons Manchin has kept that party line infrastructure bill moving forward, even as it gets bigger and bigger, because he understands what that represents for his districts, what it represents for his workers and his state's residents, and what it represents for him politically as a guy who can get things done. And that's what he has positioned himself as. This is his chance to deliver on it.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is, you know, the social infrastructure part that AOC and the squad is pushing forward on. And I know the right, they get all tingly in the panties and all wadded up when they talk about, you know, AOC and the left and socialism and, oh my God, the squirrel. But all the stuff that they're talking about is actually going to make their constituents' lives better. Because there are old people in blue states and red states. There are families that need caregivers in those states. There are families that need their kids to be able to go to community college. There's so many things that it doesn't matter, red, blue, purple, orange. It doesn't matter. Families need stuff. I can't believe Republicans are going, no, we're not doing any of that.
And increasingly state Republicans can't either. We've seen quite a few Republican mayors in places like Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, going on the Sunday shows and saying, I don't care what Republicans have to say to get it done. I need it to get done for my constituents because we're suffering. And if the GOP can't deliver, my constituents aren't going to vote for Republicans. It's as simple as that. It's up to Republicans to get it together for the country and come together on this, or Democrats will move forward by themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that has to happen. But I used to believe that. I used to believe that Republican voters would hold their elected officials accountable for not doing things to help them. But we've seen cycle after cycle that just not to be true, where the party of no continually brings nothing back to their districts and they still get reelected. I did, before you go, I wanted to get your thoughts on the story today about Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan and Banks not being on the commission, and evidently they're not going to have anybody. I wanted to get your thoughts on the whole scene.
Well, this is so characteristically Kevin McCarthy. This is party and politics and messaging over country every step of the way. I mean, putting in members on this commission who are active witnesses, who will need to provide testimony as to their own role in potentially instigating this riot. He knew from the beginning this was a no-go. His plan was to fill this commission with clowns because, you know, if I have a commission full of clowns, I'm not liable to take anything they say very seriously. And the hope is for the GOP that they can distract and delegitimize this so that people don't take it seriously. Because the biggest fear they have is that the truth comes out about their role in inciting this riot.
Yeah, but you know, you see this all the time, the WWGOP and their, you know, their antics. This, I fear, plays into that. I personally, if it were me, if I were Speaker Pelosi, I would have let them stay. I would have most certainly done everything I could do to neutralize them there. But by bringing them off and giving them this ability to create this whole other circus, I think that was, I don't know. I think we'll see. I think it was a bad move.
Yeah, I see your point. But at some point, we have to say that we are willing as Democrats, as patriots, to lose a couple media cycles for the greater purpose of democracy. I mean, some things are more important than getting hit hard in Politico because Nancy Pelosi is too partisan. Finding the truth about what happened on January 6th is the one singular purpose of that commission. And Nancy Pelosi should do everything she can to keep that integrity and to keep that purpose. If we start letting in jokers, it's as good as gone.
No, I'm with you, but it's a party of jokers. I mean, you know, from top to bottom, there, you know, you can't find but a handful of decent ones.
Yeah.
And that's sad because...
No argument for me.
It's sad because I used to remember a time when there were some decent Republicans that you didn't, you know, think were out to destroy our entire way of life. And this is what we're seeing.
Yeah, it is really just a difference of philosophies. It's one party that's interested in fixing the problems in democracy that led to what happened on January 6th, and another party looking at how to deny it happened while figuring out how to exploit that for 2022 and 2024. You're not going to come together in consensus on this. This is democracy and anti-democracy. And democracy has to be what we go with.
Yeah. So what do you expect to come Tuesday? Because I guess day one, Tuesday, right?
Yep. This is certainly going to be fireworks. I don't want to prejudge any of it, but I'm certain that what we're going to see will be explosive either way. There's certainly things that are going to come forward that have not been publicly discussed fully yet with regards to Capitol security that I think are really going to shock a lot of Americans.
No, I think this is important, and it's something that I hope everyone pays attention to. Max, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work that you do over there at the Daily Beast. As this continues, love to have you come back on and share some thoughts with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Good stuff. Our good friend Max Burns. Make sure you check out his work over at the Daily Beast. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1878. That was the day that a new song was introduced to the U.S. labor movement. Reverend Jesse H. Jones set the lyrics of a poem that had been written by I.G. Blanchard more than a decade earlier. The song was called The 8-Hour Day. The fight for 8 hours had become one of the central causes of labor. In 1850, the average work week was 70 hours. This meant that workers had little time for anything else beside their daily toil. After the Civil War, calls for the 8-hour day gained momentum. It became a movement that united workers from different workplaces and backgrounds. 8-hour leagues were formed in cities across the nation. They hosted talks and rallies to spread the word about the need to shorten the work week. At rallies, protesters waved 8-hour banners. They also sang the song that became their anthem. The first verse boldly began, "We mean to make things over. We are tired of toil for naught, with but bare enough to live upon, and never an hour for thought. We want to feel the sunshine. We want to smell the flowers. We are sure that God has willed it, and we mean to have 8 hours. We're summoning our forces from the shipyard, shop, and mill. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will." The 8-Hour Day song continues to be reimagined today, including this version by Rhythm Fest.
Hey, 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 hey
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, the first day of the Olympics in Tokyo, Japan, the number 2 softball team, beat the number 8 ranked Australian women's team 8-1. Evidently, the U.S. is softball team, the top-ranked team, beat Italy in the second game. Sad news, the women's soccer team went down 3-0 to Sweden. Sadly, nobody in the stands, nobody gets to see this because this is the COVID Olympics. There will be no spectators. There will be none of that. We can all watch it on TV. And I'm waiting for the time where maybe we just do the Olympics via Zoom. All of the athletes get to stay home and they get to run at home. And then you just put it together on a Zoom camera and do something like that. So we don't have to have these debacles in city after city. I'm here to share some thoughts on the upcoming Olympics or the current Olympics. And, well, the disaster that we've seen thus far. I've asked Timothy Noah to come talk with us. He's got a new piece out on this very topic of giving Greece back the Olympics. Timothy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So, thus far, does this Olympics in Tokyo, does this match up to the past ones that we've seen in Athens and Atlanta and other places?
Seems like it's a little worse. It's a real problem when you can't get people into the stadiums, right? Or the arenas. You know, the thing is, every 4 years, there is some mess up. It's a quadrennial ritual. Every 4 years, there are going to be stories about how completely unready the host country is to host the Olympics. And, it's not a big surprise. It's a completely new effort for each country. Even if they've hosted before, it's usually so long ago that nobody remembers exactly how it's done. It's an incredibly expensive proposition, and it's very wasteful, it seems to me. I think that rather than have this traveling show that doesn't work very well, we should just return the Olympics to Greece.
Yeah, I read that, and I'm going, I've heard it before, that we should pick a central location and build, really good infrastructure that it's going to get some regular use, because, you get the Olympics every couple of years, and I look at Brazil, for instance, when they did it, they built a whole bunch of stuff that, doesn't get used. In fact, I think at one point they turned some of it into homeless housing or something like that. I mean, it was, you had no more use for it. And right. It just seems, like you said, a lot of wasteful spending. But this Olympic is a little different. You're in the midst of a global pandemic in a country that is really one of the lower vaccinated countries in the world.
Right. It's last I checked, they were below 20%. It's incredibly dangerous and insane for them to be doing this. Apparently, the Japanese, there have been polls in Japan. People don't want to proceed with this. It just makes no sense at all.
And the athletes, every time I turn around, there's another athlete or another, somebody else can't play because or can't participate because they've tested positive. And the only reason I found out that there is a women's 3-on-3 event is because Katie Lou Samuelson, someone my daughter really liked from UConn, got COVID and isn't going to be able to participate. And I'm going, when did we get 3-on-3 basketball in the Olympics? Did I miss that?
It's crazy. And Japan has declared actually a public health emergency. They've literally declared their own Olympics to be a public health emergency. The Tokyo is going to be in a state of public health emergency until the end of the Olympics. It's ridiculous.
So, in looking at this, do you think they should have just canceled the whole thing? As, they did last year, they postponed it. Is this a postponed thing? Is this a canceled thing? Where do you think this should have gone?
I think they should have either canceled or postponed. It sort of blows my mind that there wasn't close coordination between the folks who were monitoring the vaccination rate and the folks who were planning the Olympics. Maybe there was close coordination and they just didn't care. But it seems to be 20%. It really is not good enough.
Yeah, no, that's terrible.
Here in the United States, we're having a we're having a surge right now, and we're above 60%. That's not good enough either. But certainly 20% is really a big problem.
Now, who are we most concerned about? Are we concerned about the citizens of Japan because we're bringing all these people from around the world and all the variants and all the different strains from around the world are converging onto one place? Or are we concerned about the athletes who, again, are going to be in these kind of close quarters in these Olympic villages on the cardboard beds that we've heard so much about? Where are we most concerned, you think?
Well, why do we have to choose? I mean, I think it's bad for I'm concerned about all of them. The COVID vaccine doesn't distinguish between who's a Japanese citizen and who's a visiting athlete from another country. This should not be taking place. It seems very clear to me that this is a bad public policy call.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree. But I have friends who are like, no, we need this. We need this in this moment, Timothy. We need this moment to lift up the country because sports brings us together. You know, all
well,
that wonderful
we?
Stuff.
I mean, is by we, do you mean Americans? Because, yeah, we've got, globally speaking, we've got a relatively high vaccination rate. We can invite friends over to watch the Olympics. There are many countries around the world where that's not such a good idea still.
Now, moving forward in the post, let's say we get past this, in the post, COVID era, or waiting for the next, virus to come up and jump, bite us in the behind. These large scale events, do you ever see them coming back to where they were pre-pandemic?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think they will come back. I think that they're already starting to come back in the United States on a, sort of very kind of cost proceeding. The states are proceeding very cautiously, and at first I thought that was foolish, but now I realize, no, that's wise, because you do have to worry about who's gotten the vaccine, who hasn't. There's an incredible amount of timidity about asking people whether they've been vaccinated or not. I mean, I really applaud Springsteen on Broadway for it's the only Broadway show, or it was the first Broadway show that came back up, and they made everybody provide evidence that they'd been vaccinated before they let them in, and that's a good policy. I don't want to go up places where there are people who are unvaccinated, and I risk getting the Delta variant.
Yeah. No, I was just reading a thing today that only like 43% of New York City police and support staff are vaccinated, and I'm like, that's not surprising to me.
Right.
The fact is now you've got to worry about the police not just coming and arresting you, but making you sick.
We got to get the vaccination numbers up. Absolutely. And I think that really what needs to happen is that Biden needs to issue a national mandate for people to either wear a mask or be vaccinated when they go back to work. Which he, there was going to be an OSHA temporary standard that was going to be issued in March, and he chickened out.
Wow, I'm imagining the insanity that comes after that order, because I'm sure you remember Michigan and Ohio and here in Pennsylvania, all of the anti-maskers coming out and basically looking like zombies, on their last march for brains. I can't imagine what would happen if you said, no, not just that you have to wear a mask, but now we're gonna make sure you get the shot. I cannot imagine what that's going to look like.
Well, it would probably be bad, but it's worse to have people die unnecessarily.
But what do you say to the person? Because, I've been looking at this going, some of the news coming out has said that, basically the unvaccinated folks are the ones who are getting most sick. They're the ones who are, filling up our hospital ERs, yep, and filling up our ICUs, and they're the ones who are dying. What's wrong with going, good?
Well, it's never good to have fellow human beings getting sick and dying. I mean, it just isn't.
Well, you make a choice.
Even people who make bad choices shouldn't. We should find ways to get them vaccinated. And you can't you can make somebody, an employer can say you have to get vaccinated if you want to come back to work, because the employee can say, well, okay, I won't go back to work. So this is private enterprise, which the conservatives are supposed to love, right? But employers aren't doing it very much. And so I think the government would actually be doing private enterprise a great favor if they just stated the rules of the road, and then employers could shrug and say, hey, I don't like it, but the government's making me do it.
Yeah, no, I get that all the time. You have to wear a mask because Tom Wolf said so, and we hate him, but we have to wear it anyway. Get it all the time. But hey, I guess if it makes you follow the rules and do that, then great. But what do you do with the people who are so vehemently dug in? You know, my wife went back finally to go get her occasional massage. And the woman who does the massage said, you know, she's had people come back and refuse to come back because she's been vaccinated. And I forget what was the one that the one told her that because she's been vaccinated, she's got the mark of the beast in her and she's now Satan. And another one said that, you know, there's going to be a slough off and she's going to make her sterile. I mean, there's all of this insane kind of misinformation and just out and out lies out there. How do you combat that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a tough one. But how many people are we talking about who were saying stuff like that to this masseuse?
Well, I mean, you know, enough that she's closing her business and taking it home. You know, enough people that are, you know, her business is severely hampered. And look, I know a bunch of people who believe the Facebook memes, who believe that, you know, they're putting microchips in people, and it's really kind of, it's kind of scary. And look, I've got some union friends who are, you know, rallying to say, no, we are not going to let the employers mandate that we have to have vaccines. I mean, it's that kind of an issue that I think is pretty, you know, pretty contentious.
I would expect that the union leadership would say, we don't want to come back unless you make sure people are vaccinated, because we want to protect the health of our workers.
You would think, wouldn't you?
That is their job.
You know, one would think that, again, this is democracy in the workplace, and you would hope that the majority of workers would go, yeah, we would all like to be safe, thank you very much. But what do you do in an environment where the majority of workers, because unions are democracy in the workplace, say, no, we're not going to do it? That's where some of these unions are in trouble. And these are healthcare unions.
Well, I'll tell you, we have filling in for an editor at the Washington Monthly and posting things online. And tomorrow, we're posting a piece by Stephen Waldman, who runs a project called Report for America. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's modeled on Teach for America, and it sends reporters out to local newsrooms, young reporters. And he has a piece that's going up on the website tomorrow that says one way to fight this misinformation is to increase the number of people who are reporting local news, because he said it's interesting. When people's diet consists only of national news, that's very polarizing. When people have a balance of national news but also local news, they bring a little more common sense to the table, because local news isn't nearly as polarizing, and there are divisions, but they're, you know, it's not team A and team B. The divisions are sort of more complicated, and people agree about some things, don't agree about other things. And he thinks that this is a good way to disseminate better information.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I've been saying for years we need to break up some of these major conglomerates and fund local reporting and local investigative news. I'm all on board with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
We most certainly need it. Too many of these giants have bought up local newspapers, and we're just running, you know, national stories in them. Before I let you go, I want to get back to the original story. We kind of went off a little bit on the virus, but, you know, it fits with the story. In looking at, you know, Olympics going forward, I liked your idea of, you know, we should take this back to Greece, or pick a location. Any chance of something like that ever happening?
Greece invented the Olympics. You know,
I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Olympics were in Greece for 1,000 years. You wouldn't have the Rose Bowl in Burkina Faso, would you? So why do you have the Olympics anywhere except Greece?
And how do you see that working out?
Well, they probably need a little financial help to make it happen. I think the EU could help. Maybe the European Central Bank could help. Maybe the IOC could share some broadcast revenue with Greece to give the Greeks an incentive to run the thing right. And, you know, they probably, the first couple of times they did it, it would probably be a bit of a mess, as Olympics always are. But you would think that if they do it, you know, by the third time or the fourth time, they would know how to do it, because it'll be something they've done before, yeah. Something they know how to do.
And maybe we could just, you know, we won't have to hear these insane stories every year about cardboard beds and all the usual stories that come along every Olympic cycle.
Absolutely.
We will see how it goes. But Timothy, I appreciate the work that you do. Good stuff. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Timothy Noah, columnist there at the New Republic. Also got this piece over at the Washington Monthly. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. And, you know, make sure you check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. But what do you think of that? What do you think of the idea of going, you know what? No more cities outbidding each other. No more cities wasting huge amounts of money on building infrastructure that we're probably not going to use for anything else. Building huge stadiums and arenas and stuff that we don't need when we've got other ones that are still functional. What do you think of that? Do you think that's a smart idea? Do you think it's somewhere we should move toward? Because I'll tell you, you look at the amount of money that gets spent on these events, these massive events, they never pay for themselves. They never generate enough revenue. They never bring in enough cash to make sure that that it gets paid for. So to me, it sounds like a good idea. And look, Greece is still in trouble. This could be a boost where they get a little income every year. Sounds like a win-win to me. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931, and Chicago public school teachers went home without a paycheck. The school system was broke. Property owners out of work due to the Great Depression could not pay their property taxes, which were used to fund the public schools. Schools in inner cities lacked libraries, playgrounds, and often even adequate toilet facilities. Classrooms were overcrowded. Black teachers faced racial discrimination. School administrators piled on more clerical work onto teachers' already busy workloads. They introduced a blizzard of standardized tests. Still, according to an article published in 1927 in the American Teacher magazine, teachers were supposed to believe that teaching was a noble profession, free and immune from the cares of the more sordid world. The same article went on to say that many teachers, quote, believed their personal dignity and self-respect required that they keep aloof from any organization affiliated with labor. The Great Depression made teachers more militant. However, Chicago teachers stayed on the job despite the payless paydays. One Chicago teacher explained that they were determined not to desert the Chicago schools. It was not easy organizing Chicago's teachers. Only 10% of the teachers belonged to the four competing teachers' unions. But not getting paid helped arouse them. And 2 years later, 5,000 teachers converged on Chicago's largest banks in protest. They broke windows and overturned desks. Chicago's mayor, Ed Kelly, agreed to pay 4 of the 9 months back pay owed to them. Finally, in 1934, thanks to federal assistance, the Chicago teachers received all of their back pay. You only need read about the current Chicago teachers' struggle to see that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.